Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my background at rajbalkaran.com/academia. More importantly, I have the pleasure of speaking today with Marco Ghislani, who's assistant professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of South Carolina, Columbia. And we are speaking about his 2018 Oxford University Press publication, Rites of the God King. Hello, Marco, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Raj. Thanks for having me.
So if I'm not mistaken, Marco, you and I have sort of been having parallel movements, you know, in the field. We haven't really had a chance to connect or speak, but we were at a conference together in 2011, correct?
Yeah, shout outs to the University of Toronto.
Yes, the University of Toronto. It was their very first South Asian graduate student conference, if I recall, and they do it biennially now. And since 2011, we both had an adventure. We both grown up out of grad school.
Yeah. I was just finishing at that time, and you were in the middle, or you finished a couple of years later?
Oh, you know what? 2011 is the year I started.
Okay.
It was my first year, but I did my PhD a bit faster than some, I'd
right.
say. So I defended, say, 2015, if I recall.
Okay. Yeah, so I had just finished at that time.
Oh, nice. And you no doubt have a rewarding job teaching and researching out there?
Yeah, I've been in the States for forever now. I'm from Toronto, but I've been in the U.S. since 2005, so I've been working the whole time.
Oh, you can take the scholar out of Toronto, but you can't take the Toronto.
That's right.
The scholar. So a couple of things. I've been meaning to chat with you irrespective of the podcast, but the podcast is the perfect excuse because in addition to the book that we're going to dive into, you recently attended a workshop about a month ago.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. It's very much related to the book. So we'll maybe talk a bit about that as well, because I'd love to hear about it because it relates to a burgeoning strand of my own research. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the genesis of Rites of the God King?
Yeah, okay. So this book already came out last year, so already in hindsight, I can see how I would historicize this project in the long term as kind of representing a moment in three different fields: religious studies, South Asian studies, and Hindu studies. I was trained in the mid-aughts, really, and I think that at the most primal level for me as an intellectual biography, this book is a partial answer to a question I've had since as an undergraduate, which is essentially what exactly is the ritual culture of the Puranas. Like many undergraduates who begin in Hindu studies, we encounter this religion through the Puranas, these texts from the early medieval period that kind of are compendia of myth and ritual and other material. And I was always sort of struck by the dissonance between conventional approaches to these texts around the early aughts, which were sort of inspired very much by a kind of comparative structural mythological and slightly literary approach. And as I started working with these texts more closely, I felt like there was something about the genre of the Puranas that was not really being captured in at least that sort of introductory way of thinking about the Puranas as sectarian myths. And so really my interest was to try to, from the beginning, was to try to look at Puranas from sort of non-sectarian, non-mythological perspectives. And so I started really working in sort of regional Puranic traditions, geographical Puranas, with an attempt to sort of try to historicize those texts and that genre. And so my early work was really inspired by what I think is a, in the last generation, a kind of historicizing, rehistoricizing of early Hinduism in general, and of course the Puranas within this wider kind of historical framework. And I think specifically of the work that Hans Bakker was doing, or is continuing to do, of course, around the early Skanda, and thinking about Puranic formation over time with using different texts. And so, you know, in that moment there, in my mind as a graduate student, you have, you know, people historicizing the Dharma Shastras, people historicizing Puranic literature, people historicizing Tantric literature. And in many ways, the first millennium was really open to me, it felt like. And among the questions that were coming out of that period were some sorts, some hesitations around conventional narratives having to do with Hinduism as we understand it sort of in the classroom. And one of those questions was about what exactly is the status of image worship and the origin of image worship in the history of Hinduism. And I think specifically of some of the essays written by my advisor, Phyllis Granoff, and Gerard Collat, who were sort of problematizing this idea that the core of this tradition is this kind of shift between sacrifice and image worship. So that's one part of the genesis was sort of my coming of age in the field, historicizing the first millennium through a kind of philological approach. And another aspect of the project, I think, had to do with a whole sort of tradition of ethnography, sort of post-Demontian ethnography, coming out of the 80s and 90s, and sometimes more explicitly, more or less explicitly attached to a post-Orientalist critique. That we're sort of criticizing the older sort of Brahmin purity-centric model of Hindu society and really rethinking the question of kingship. So then the work of Ronald Indian in a way was a major statement, I think, which was trying to sort of reconstruct what exactly was the pattern of kingship in the medieval period, specifically as a way of answering some of the critiques of colonialism and Orientalism. So there's that sort of more South Asian moment. And then the third thing would be just my training in religious studies and an interest in ritual studies, which sort of allowed me, I think, to tie together some of these interests, hopefully in a bit of a coherent picture to connect these early texts to some of the later concerns in the wider South Asian studies. And one of the crucial moments for me was the discovery of the work of Shingo Eino, who's a Japanese Vedicist who put a lot of effort into bringing to light these texts called the Parishishtas, the Grihasutra Parishishtas. And these are ritual manuals that kind of come at the end of the Vedic period that I found very useful for understanding some of the rituals that I was finding in the Puranas. And so that that corpus of text then shifted my focus away from Puranic literature to really the history of ritual practice as such.
Well, there's certainly a lot to chew on in terms of the background and the various strands that have come into this line of inquiry. Maybe tell us just very broadly what the main takeaways of this book are. such that a general audience might understand where it fits. I mean, you do a really good job of succinctly recapitulating it, I believe, in the first paragraph of your conclusion. But what would you say to a broad audience? What is the main theme, value of this book?
So we have an image of Hinduism in relationship to temple practice. That is the idea that at the core of Hinduism are rituals of worshiping an image. That idea is often held in tension with an older idea, an idea of an older religion in Hinduism known as Vedism, right? That is concerned with sapphire sacrifice. And in the sort of tradition of thinking about Hinduism in the West, these two images have been held in a certain kind of tension. I would say that my argument is that there is a lot of continuity, ritual continuity between those texts. And in order to see that continuity, we have to understand the history of political rituals in South Asia. The book, in essence, then charts the life of a ritual known as Shanti, which was designed to protect people from inauspicious omens. And the way that they protected people was by bathing them. Bathing them using a specially empowered set of mantras and water. And I argue that it's this, if we trace the history of this specific ritual form, we will see that there is incredible continuity between this earlier Vedic ritual culture and the later culture that we understand as Hinduism. And in order to understand that, however, we have to accept that there was this very vibrant political culture that I think in many ways we've not really paid so much attention to because of the ways that we've understood Hinduism as religious, and the specific way that that term religious impinges on our notion of Hinduism.
So one of the themes that comes up in this podcast on Hindu studies is this very serious issue of what on earth is Hinduism?
Yeah,
and more than just cerebral problematizing the way academics are sometimes prone to. More than any other religion, Hinduism is very much a group of things. I consider it an ecosystem more than a definitive tradition. And for example, last week, in fact, there was the conference of the European Association for the Study of Religion. At which I presented on a panel basically called Moving Beyond Quote Unquote Hinduism, But How?
Mm-hmm.
So this is an issue. So if anyone out there is confused about what Hinduism is, you're in good company.
Right.
But one of the key ideas that Marco's working with is this distinction, and some listeners may be surprised that this distinction exists, some may not be, but this distinction between Vedicism and Hinduism. So before we delve into the ways in which your work problematizes or bridges this potentially false distinction, maybe drill down a little bit on what do you mean Hinduism versus Vedicism?
Right. Well, the way that I introduce it in the book actually is using two different educational videos that are often shown in introduction to Hinduism classes. One is this well-known documentary, Altar of Fire, by Robert Gardner and Fritz Stahl, produced in the 1970s, which gives a picture of this Agni Chaya ritual, one of the most elaborate Vedic sacrifices, in order to illustrate the Vedic sacrifice, which is an ancient sacrifice. The video tells us it's this ancient sacrifice. It's an aniconic sacrifice, meaning there are no images. And the basic logic is that you offer food offerings into the fire. The gods have been invited to this fire through praise poetry, and they receive those offerings. And the whole process, aside from the fire itself, is invisible, right? And this was a dominant mode of ritual practice, as far as the evidence available to us says, from the early first millennium, probably before the first millennium BCE onward. In a traditional history of Hinduism, then there's a major break that's supposed to happen, and that break is not really well historicized. Sometime, probably around the Gupta period, or slightly earlier, where the whole ritual culture of this tradition changes dramatically to center then on the worship of physical images, statues, often, who are representations or actually instantiations of divinity, of the gods. And these gods, typically Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess, are not necessarily, well, some of them are, of course, precedented in the Vedic texts, but they seem to be new in a way. And so this is the sort of the basic structure of Vedism and Hinduism. The second, the Hindu practice, one of the ways that we introduce this in the classroom is through this video, Puja Expressions of Divine Devotion, which was produced at the Sackler Gallery in 1996, I think. And what's interesting about this, if you compare it to the Altar of Fire video, is that we see these depictions of image worship in contemporary, very contemporary scene in Hinduism, in Maryland, in some diasporic settings especially. And what strikes me about this this presentation is that on the one hand, you have an aspect of the tradition that is presented as very archaic. And on the other hand, you have a tradition of image worship that is presented as highly modern. And part of the puzzlement is that sort of temporal puzzlement is at the core of this book. Why is it that parts of the tradition are presented in a highly contemporary way and other parts are presented in this sort of ancient way?
So, for example, if someone currently visits a Hindu temple, whether as a practitioner or as a researcher, just to bring to life this, the potential falsity of this distinction. For example, right. There is a relatively famous temple just north of Toronto. It's a South Indian, it's a Tamil temple, the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple. There may be a festival to a deity. Let's just say it's a Shiva festival. You know, you're going to go during that festival and you will see iconic worship of Shiva with puja rituals, but you're also going to see a fire ritual wherein Vedic mantras are intoned.
Right.
And you may even hear hymns. You know, you may even hear, for example, like the Mrityunjaya Mantra, penned to the Rig Veda. And so in modern Hindu practice, the religiosity of fire sacrifice in the Vedic incantation and the religiosity of temple worship or veneration of icons, there really is no disjunction in terms of modern Hindu practice. And would you agree with that?
Correct. The Vedic sacrifice survives in many different forms in the context of temple Hinduism. Absolutely. But in sort of depictions of Hinduism, one of the things that we fixate on, and one of the things I'm sort of grappling with is in this book, is why we fixate so much on the image. And my answer to that fixation has to do with, you know, a whole set of anxieties coming out of the colonial period in relation to the charge of idolatry by missionaries in India.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. There's certainly something to be said about the elements of Hinduism, which are most jarring to Abrahamic ideology or the religions of the book, shall we say, from a world religion perspective. So why don't you tell us, you've told us essentially what you hope to accomplish. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the evidence, maybe the two classes of texts that you look at and what the texts have to say?
Right. So at the core of the sort of textual project is trying to bring to life what I think was a professional interaction between late Vedic specialists, ritual specialists, and astrologers sometime in the first half of the first millennium CE. And the story I'm trying to tell there is how the problem of omens and inauspiciousness was dealt with, which was brought into South Asia by this new astrological tradition that forms in this period. How this problem of omens and inauspiciousness was then solved by ritual specialists. And so it's about the invention of a new ritual that emerges from this interaction. And we see this interaction when we compare Vedic ritual texts with the astrological ones. And over time, we see on the one hand, the increasing awareness of omens in these late Vedic ritual manuals. And on the other hand, the increasing salience and familiarity with ritual prescriptions in the astrological texts. And the texts I'm referring to are especially the ritual manuals of the late Atharvaveda, the Shantikalpa and the Atharvaveda Parishishtas on the one hand, and on the other hand, the ritual corpus of Varahamihira, this very well-known Indian astronomer of the 6th century.
So before you proceed, help me clarify something in terms of Jyotisha, or as you call it, astral science, which mm-hmm. is more or less a hybrid of what we would call astronomy, astrology, omenology. So we'll call it Jyotisha. So sure. The listener will know when we say Jyotisha, we mean Indian astral sciences. Tell us about this idea that Indian astral sciences or Jyotisha enters the subcontinent, and it's you know, tell us about whether or not this is indigenous or whether this is stemming from a different source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a big question, a long-standing debate in the study of South Asian astral science. David Pingree, who more than anyone worked to map out the field of astral science, is well known for having made the argument that solar astronomy enters into India from the West sometime, well, in different phases, but certainly the planetary, the solar-based astronomy enters in, especially around the second to third centuries CE. And this is related to the shift in the civil calendar. We see weekdays in the inscriptions, the name of the planetary weekdays in around the fifth century, I think. So there is this longstanding history that let's sort of debate, there is a whole new generation of people working, especially on these astral texts that are you know, trying to complicate this picture. For my purposes, it's sort of less important the origination of the astral science, but what's important is that we can date the emergence of the Sanskritic astral Jyotisha material fairly well with Varahamihira in the 6th century. And of course, Varahamihira is himself appropriating and amalgamating a whole centuries-long history of astral sciences. And so his text is actually, I see his text as a little bit apologetic to the Brahminical establishment, in terms of still trying to make the argument for this science. So certainly the novelty of this tradition is really relevant for this project, because it gives us a kind of signpost in between the earlier Vedic period and the sort of Puranic period of some sort of new ritual developments associated with Jyotisha.
Mm-hmm. And so so essentially, you, in terms of your use of the Atharvavedic texts and the Jyotisha, tell us a bit more about Shanti, or this idea of appeasement, yeah. Or the ideology of appeasement is probably something worth unpacking for the audience.
Absolutely. So this term Shanti, which most of the audience will probably translate as peace, is a term that we find in the early Vedic literature having to do with aspects of the ritual that are dangerous, that need to be appeased in different ways. So it means appeasement of, in this earliest sense, it means, has a sense of appeasement of dangerous substances like hot things, fire, coals are often, you know, appeased, or sickness. And so it's kind of a minor ritual term in the earlier Vedic texts. What I argue in the book is that this term then at a certain point in the Vedic sort of experience, omens enter into their purview of the priestly class as something they need to deal with. And in the earliest texts, the rituals to deal with bad omens, say like lightning striking the ground or earthquakes or strange rains, these start to filter into the texts. And the way that the Vedic ritualists deal with them early on is through this category of prayaschitta or prayaschitti, which means atonement for ritual mistakes. So in some ways, this new problem of omens is dealt with in a very old way. We're just going to do a simple sacrifice. You know, if the dawns don't appear, for example, we'll say a mantra related to the dawn in the context of a fire sacrifice, and that should do the work of appeasement, of dealing with this omen. As more and more divinatory literature enters into the Vedic purview, we see a new ritual and a new ritual name applied to this problem. And that's this term shanti or appeasement. And it occurs in the first place in these ancillary ritual texts of the Atharva Veda. And the new ritual designed for that has to do with the use of appeasement waters. These are waters which were earlier used to cure sickness, other sort of if something's lost, other remedial uses in the Atharva Veda. But in this late manual, this and this water is actually produced by this very complicated thing where they put mantras essentially into the water in different ways, right? When at a certain point they decide we need a new ritual called shanti to deal specifically with omens, and we're going to design that ritual around this ritual instrument of shanti water by putting mantras into the water through the use of the dregs of the sacrifice. So in a typical Vedic sacrifice, you have this moment where you pronounce the main formula of the ritual, and then then you finish the ritual. In this sort of revised sacrifice, what they do is they take the dreg, they pronounce these mantras, and they take the dregs of those mantras and they add them to a water pot as a way of charging up the water with sort of mantric power. And that water is then used to bathe the officiant and protecting in a way of protecting them. And so this is the sort of the core moment when there's a new ritual technique applied to these omens, and it sort of develops from there.
And this ritual technique is significant because it shows conversation or continuity between traditions.
Yeah, I think on the one hand, it shows how flexible the Vedic priesthood was, it wasn't as if they were unable to transform, to derive new rituals, but they derive new rituals by appealing to earlier kinds of techniques. So the shanti water technique precedes the ritual category of shanti. Of course, the Vedic sacrifice itself precedes the ritual of shanti, but those are the things that are available to the tradition when they're confronted with a new problem. So on the one hand, it's a sort of very continuous orthopraxy, or ritual, or a kind of prescribed ritual tradition. On the other hand, you see that the omens themselves are a new problem, and that problem is linked to a whole other set of literature that was probably not very early on sanctioned or was questionable within the orthodoxy. So the ritual itself kind of it connects to a historical tradition, but it also shows adaptation to a new historical problem.
So when would you say this new horizon of omenological disturbance or issue? I understand that dating in South Asia is a hazardous affair.
Yeah.
But when approximately would you say this becomes a problem? The reason I ask is because I have a follow-up question. I'm curious to know where you would place that.
Okay, great. Yeah, so, you know, the dating's hard, as you said, but at least we have some dating. We know Varahamihira is operating in the 6th century. He's operating at the end of a lineage of Sanskritic sources, more or less Sanskritic sources that he cites. And we have the earliest, one of the earliest texts that he cites is this work by a sage named Garga. And this text has been dated close to the turn of the first of the Common Era. You know, that is still something where there's a group of us working on this text, and it's still something that we're, you know, thinking about. But we basically have this, you know, half millennial period from the turn of the perhaps the turn of the Common Era to the Gupta end of the Gupta period, where we know that there's a sort of a development of this Jyotish material. The Vedic texts themselves, those are harder to date. Pingri thought these earliest divinatory texts, the earliest one is in a text called the Kaushika Sutra, which is the earliest ritual manual of the Atharva Veda. You know, who knows, that may be closer to the middle of the first millennium BCE. It's a composite text. I think the omen section is a little bit, obviously a little bit later. So we could be going back to Ashokan times or, you know, Mauryan times. It wouldn't be surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
The other Vedic texts sort of develop in sequence from this earliest Kaushika Sutra. So what's sort of, you know, key to the method of the book is that we have a kind of chronology within textual corpuses that helps us to at least say, show the development of this ritual tradition over time. And in the book, I try to argue, it's not, of course, conclusive, but I think I'm fairly convinced anyways that Varahamihira in the 6th century was working with the paradigms of the Atharva, of these late Atharvan texts.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because even by the time of the Valmiki Ramayana, and of course there's hot debate about when that could be itself.
Absolutely.
Composed in a period smaller than the overall composition of the Mahabharata, but plus or minus a couple centuries CE, who knows?
And you see a ton of this omen material in the Mahabharata as well.
Yeah, and even in the Ramayana, you see certainly there's some omenological material, if I recall.
Absolutely.
But there certainly is knowledge of Jyotisha, because one of the reasons why they elect Rama's coronation was because of the full moon in Pusha.
Pusha, yes, correct.
And there's a whole subsection and a chapter about the importance of that lunar asterism in terms of rituals of kingship.
Mm-hmm.
And so why don't you tell us or you know, connect the dots for us in terms of the Shanti rituals and the Shanti rituals related to kingship and the institution of kingship and how that may foyer into what we now consider temple religion.
Great. Yeah. So this is really the middle of the book. Up to this point, we really haven't dealt with sort of temple Hinduism per se. Varahamihira essentially for me crystallizes a royal ritual culture wherein these aspersion rituals, I call them, bathing or sprinkling rituals, were used to protect royal elites, especially the king, from inauspicious omens. And in Varahamihira, we start to actually see how this becomes theorized, that the king has to be protected because he is the root of the tree of the people. And so there is this kind of centralizing of inauspiciousness, of the problem of auspiciousness and inauspiciousness in the king, in the body of the king. And I argue that this sort of culture of ritual appeasement that Varahamihira is arguing is how the state really operates, that the king has to be protected so that the nation will be protected. Travels onward into what become very mainstream coronation rituals in the early medieval period, as evidenced in the Rajadharma texts of Vishnudharamotra and Matsya Purana. So essentially by the end of the first millennium, we see this royal ritual culture really kind of flourishing. And my argument is that the earliest records of temple worship that we have, especially the ritual of the installation of a permanent image, were essentially borrowing, or the borrowing is probably too weak of a word. They were constructed in the image of the royal ritual cult that centered on these aspersion or bathing rites. In other words, if the king then at his coronation is bathed with these protective waters, when you install an image in a temple, you have to use the same ritual paradigm, right? And that's one of the questions I ask in the book is, why do we, when we install a god in an image in a temple, why do we have to bathe that that god? And so the argument is essentially that the whole complex, or at least in this earliest instances, the complex of temple worship, beginning with installation and then following with regular worship, was an analog, designed as an analog to what the body of the king goes through in a in it, his ritual calendar.
Mm-hmm. And even beyond the bathing aspect, where you know one may conjecture or speculate that ritual baths may have been an ancient practice.
Yes,
there's you know. Some even theorize an Indus Valley remnant of right. ritual bathing. Nevertheless, when you do see a murti installed, or not even installed on a daily basis in mm-hmm. a temple where they're doing the full rituals, for the full abhisheka, they'll do the ritual bath, but then they'll not just offer puja items such as fruit or incense or the flame, the puja mm-hmm. items that represent the five elements. They will treat the murti as a royal guest. They'll right. use a royal fan, for example.
Yes.
They'll have some sort of procession where you carry the murti about as you
yes.
carry about a king.
Yeah.
And so just to clarify, you are saying that the royal ritual cult may well be the prime progenitor to the way in which murtis are ritually bathed in worship.
Correct. Yeah. So rather than thinking of the divinization of kingship, I'm proposing the regalization of gods.
Mm. That's fascinating. This question had occurred to me. Of course, I also work with Puranas, I work with texts, I work with mm-hmm. kingship, but I don't work typically with lived religious tradition in the sense of what people are doing on the ground at the moment, although, of course, it interests me greatly. But when you do go to, as I say, I've mentioned the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple, I go there, it's phenomenal, actually. It's phenomenal, the upkeep of that temple mm-hmm. and the various rituals and the various murtis, and it's large and it's ornate, and the festivals are just out of this world in terms of their scale. But I often had filed away this very question of what is the why is there this royal treatment of the murtis?
Right.
Why are they treated like royalty? Why is there this like royal fan, for example? What mm-hmm. what's happening here? What's up with that? So I was intrigued by your suggestion in your book.
Let me just jump in there because I think this is part of this gets us to some of the larger issues about the question of political ritual. I think we've tended to abstract the religious, obviously, from the political and the social in thinking about the history of India. We take for granted that how rituals, religious rituals, quote unquote, religious rituals develop are somehow abstracted from other social forms. And that to me is absolutely part of the legacy of colonialism. And that's what's really at stake in the critique of Dubont, who, you know, as you write about in your book as well, sort of produced this ossified image of the sort of Brahminical priesthood standing above the king. And that being sort of crucial to the secularization of the state, separation of religion, state and religion, and the ultimate supremacy, right, of the Brahmin, of the priesthood class over the political class. what I'm trying to show in the book is that, let me first say about that there's a whole tradition of ethnography and ethnohistory that shows that that sort of model didn't actually work in colonial times and doesn't work in terms of a lot of ethnographic evidence on the ground. That the organization of society really does center around some notion of kingship. What I'm trying to show in the book is that there is a longer history of these royal rights without which I don't think we can properly understand what's happening in temple Hinduism.
I definitely think you're onto something in terms of the specific argument you make. In terms of the general observation, I have no doubt that there was a great deal of imposition in terms of the distinction between sacred and secular. It's a very different tradition, right? Like mm-hmm. Indian religions, it's really hard to grapple with, especially coming from traditions as we come from and that we're trained in the West, the background of which is Abrahamic ideology. It's extremely difficult to grapple with the idea that the divine can actually exist in a quote-unquote statue or a murti. Mm-hmm. This interpenetration between sacred and secular power, I think, you know, the labor exchange between the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas doesn't clearly, through the lens of Brahminic ideology, clearly the Brahmins are at the apex of that.
Right.
Of that, but that's model.
But that's not the only model available.
Right? Exactly, and also even through that lens, the hegemony is tenuous at best. You can tell that the picture is being painted such that the Kshatriyas need the Brahmanas, but you can smell the anxiety that the reverse is true as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, I would even say that the language of like the divine and the problem of divine kingship, I think in some ways is something I almost like skirt in the book. I think that these rituals, of course, they center on the king as a galvanizing point of you know, metaphysical forces dealing with good luck and bad luck, essentially. But that, to me, is actually a separate kind of conversation from the question of his divinity. The king, I think that the easiest way to illustrate this is to say that to be the center of a ritual culture does not necessarily mean you're a god in the way that we understand divinity, the way that we use that term. And there's this great book, a recent book by Anne Mako called Demoting Vishnu, which shows how when the monarchy was deconstructed in Nepal in 2008, what they essentially did was take over the rituals of the state. And what she shows in that book is that this idea that that the king is identical with Vishnu, it's part of a kind of political discourse. You may hear that, but it's not so consequential to the actual practice of the state. The belief in the king as a god is not really what gets the medieval state or gets the monarchy moving. It's the ritual practice. That's sort of, I think, part of what I'm pointing to in the book is that these rituals kind of operated outside of theology per se. And that comes back to the point about the Puranas, that we tend to think about the history of Hinduism in terms of sectarian history. Like, when does certain such and such gods start to get worshipped, right? And then we track the history of such and such a sect. If we look at the level of practice, you'll see that the question of theology in some ways is independent from the history of ritual form.
So then the praxis, would you say, other than an affirmation or an enactment of theological truths or theological reality, would you say then that the ritual praxis was more geared towards something more pragmatic, such as the appeasement element?
Yeah, I think so. And that's the question of the religiosity of appeasement culture, which is essentially the question of the religiosity of astrology, is something I'm thinking a lot about as I move forward in my research. And there's not a clear answer. I don't really necessarily have a clear answer for that. Like I said, I think that these rituals were designed to manage some notion of auspiciousness and inauspiciousness, and that was theorized as being essential to the good of the state. I think that the question of divinity or theology intersects with that in certain ways, but it certainly does not determine the logic, its logic.
Yeah, I suspect it may or may not be useful for you to just take a quick look at the Devi Mahatmya.
Yeah, I have.
I think there's it's narratological more than theological, but it's, you know, the best way to encode, you know, these ideas is through narrative, really. And something happens with the Devi Mahatmya that I think is pertinent to what you're talking about, in that power itself becomes mm-hmm. theologized. Mm-hmm. And so, rituals of kingship occur in tandem with the Durga Puja bar none, right? And so it's very clear that the king is not the Devi, right? It's very clear that the king is not...
Right.
If it was a Vaishnava tradition, the king would not be Vishnu. The king is not the Devi. The king is sitting in an office that has some sort of, you may want to say, ritual or spiritual or religious power, insofar as power of all kind is I want to say theologized. I'm not sure if that's the best word, but I think you get a sense of what I'm driving at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
think power itself is divinized, right, and personified.
Yes.
And something's happening there that I think is really speaking to your point, but I thought about it outside of this current moment to articulate it better than that.
Right. I absolutely think that this whole idea of the concept of Shakti, you know, the right sort of political reading of that is still available in a way. And something we should definitely keep talking about.
Mm-hmm. So, so what would you two just very broad questions? What would you most want someone to take away from this book?
Yeah, I think I would say that. There are pressures on the way that we want to think about Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And part of that has to do ultimately with our concerns in the secular state, in the secular pluralist state. And what I sort of want us to sort of not lose sight of is the work of the priesthood. I think ultimately what this book is about, it's about the life of a ritual, which is about really the continuity of priestly work. And this is why this concept of orthopraxy is something that I try to make explicit at the end of the text, I think that there are a lot of politics in Hindu studies, and one of them is, and part of those politics have to do with discomfort around caste. A sort of a need in sort of especially a Western pluralist context to turn down the volume on that longstanding problem. One of the effects of that is then that we don't really think so carefully about Brahmins and what do we mean by a Brahmin, which is so kind of baked into what we understand of Hinduism, but it doesn't really show up in so much in popular accounts of Hinduism. And of course, that also has to do with anxieties coming out of the Protestant Reformation and problems with the idea of the priest in general. But I guess what I'm saying is that the work of priesthood, the work of ritual, it is continuous, I think, so much with institutional work that you mean you could see. Sorry, go ahead.
No. It strikes me. Maybe I've just internalized this, but I don't mean to say that your point is obvious. What I mean to say is that essentially I'll leave it at that. I've internalized it that the work of Brahmanism, the work of ritual, is the bedrock of anything we can call Hinduism.
Yes, absolutely.
It's, yeah. And I think in light of that insight, a distinction between Vedicism and Hinduism, or even better to your point, Brahmanism and Hinduism, the distinction becomes much more tenuous when one understands that Brahminic ideology is baked into these rituals, which ultimately are Vedic, right? Which ultimately are part of Vedic culture.
They continue Vedic orthopraxy, is how I would put it.
Sure.
And I guess that is simply to say that we cannot purify, nor should we necessarily purify our idea of Hinduism from a conception of priesthood, because I think that also speaks to ways in which we want to imagine ourselves as free consumers, citizens, while we are at the same time enmeshed in all of these bureaucratic structures, institutional structures, that people are operating and are maybe operating on their own, as like an operating system in the background, but that's happening all the time. And so I think actually that the impulse to kind of produce a Hinduism, as a kind of devotional theism around image worship, as a modern religion, is part of the same set of factors that we see in modern capitalism, it's related to the problem of modernity.
Well, that's fascinating, and clearly it does no service either to self or the tradition you're studying, in terms of trying to sanitize it to conform with anachronistically conform with modern ideals, right? Brahmanism, this caste ideology, this is part and parcel of Hinduism, no less so popular Hinduism. I mean, the Puranas are filled with narratives of how one should treat Brahmins.
Exactly.
That is taken for granted in the cultural imagination, right?
Right.
Whether or not it's taken for granted on the ground, but and this is why, to anyone who really pays close attention to or belongs to Hindu tradition, one doesn't perceive any kind of distinction between the quote-unquote Vedic elements of fire ritual and caste system and the quote-unquote popular or modern elements of ritual worship of Murtis. Mm-hmm. They really and truly do.
Right.
And in the rituals, I've paid more closer attention to them whenever I've witnessed them in the last year or so, not in small part because of these podcasts that put various pieces of Hindu studies in my brain. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating where, so there'll be let's just say it's Navaratri, it's the goddess festival. Mm-hmm. And of course they're going to worship the Murti in fine style, a full regal flair and all that. But they'll do a Vedic fire sacrifice and they'll take a thread and connect the locus, the pot in which the sacrifice is happening, to the Murti. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a symbolic joining of these two traditions.
Yeah.
And whatever they consecrate in the fire, the ash will be part of the ritual bath of the Murti. It's fascinating.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of similar kinds of images in the book. What you described reminds me of the quote I have from Donald Swearer. He's talking about the empowerment of a Buddha image, and you have this motif of the thread connecting like a electrical cord almost. So in some ways, I agree with you, and I take the point as well that from the perspective of a kind of modern temple goer, maybe this Vedic Hindu distinction is not as operative as it is in sort of the Western Indological tradition or Hindu studies tradition. But absolutely, one of the points I'm trying to make is that this is part of a kind of connected ritual culture, and that maybe we shouldn't see these different aspects of it as so distinctive.
So fascinating point, fascinating work, highly accessible read for anyone looking to pick up a copy. Why don't you tell us before we sign off, what are you working on now?
Yeah, so I'm working on a couple things. I'd say three things. One is the as part of a group of international scholars working on the early history of Jyotisha, I'm part of a project that's trying to edit this early text, the Gargiya Jyotisha, which I mentioned earlier. And so that we're doing our best to produce critical editions, or if not political editions, of that very important text in early Jyotisha, which should be coming out in the next while. In relation to that, I'm working on a sort of a follow-up book, which is I think, I'm not sure what the title will be yet, but it will be on the theme, on the relation between astrology and Hinduism. And in that book, but part of it is working using this earlier text to help to reconstruct the Hindu ritual calendar as it crystallizes in Varahamihira in the 6th century text. And that as a way of sort of theorizing a notion of the astral state. So to continue some of this work, but in what I hope to be a little bit less, a little bit more polycentric of a project that deals with different ways in which this state formation helps us to think about other problems in Hindu studies, including gender. I'm also interested in the problem of theodicy. So that's going to be that's sort of ongoing. And the third project is also related, but maybe less obviously so, is a racial critique of Hindu studies. Hopefully this is a bit of a shorter book, but it's a kind of retrospective of Hindu studies pedagogy in the last couple of generations in America specifically, and attempting to derive productive connections between Hindu studies and Asian American studies. So that's a third sort of project.
You know, I'm obviously somewhat biased, but that all sounds fascinating. It just so happens that Puranas, kingship, Jyotish, and pedagogy are very high on my list of my list of interests. So we definitely will continue talking beyond this interview. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Marco Ghislani, who is assistant professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of South Carolina, Columbia. We've been talking to Marco about his OUP 2018 publication, Rites of the God King, Shanti and Ritual Change in Early Hinduism. For all of you out there, keep reading. And Marco, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks a lot.